My name's Ross Keat. I'm a consultant in public health.
I'm Andy Davis. I'm a consultant in care of the elderly medicine.
Hello, my name's Leslie Cunningham and I am a health and wellbeing coordinator at Manx Sport and Recreation.
Are people more aware now about the importance of keeping healthy, keeping active and eating the right things more than they were, say, 10, 20 years ago, do you reckon?
Well, I think that we're exposed to a lot more in the media around potentially what healthy looks like or what the media wants us to think healthy looks like. So there might be a misrepresentation of what that means, and a lot of things which are being marketed as healthy could indeed be ultra-processed or actually very high in salts and sugars. So I think that potentially we've had our lens maybe distorted by marketing which goes on. And I think it's really key as well to remember that diet and exercise aren't just about being a healthy weight. There's plenty of links between heart disease, stroke, cancer, type 2 diabetes. People who are more physically active have better mental health, better quality of life and independence as we age, which of course takes us on to, you know, care of the elderly. So being active from a younger age means that you are going to be less likely to be frail in later life and therefore less likely to experience things like falls, and you can stay independent and mobile for longer.
Do you think people sort of take it seriously enough? Because I guess some of us are very good. We've got an awful lot of colleagues I can think downstairs who go to the gym regularly. Do you think people think enough about their sort of regime? Just think, well, it's fine. I walk to my car every day and then walk from the car to work. Is that enough?
I don't think it's a level playing field. I think that you have individuals from a whole social strata, and it's very clear that people who live in more deprived areas have less access to safe green space, good food, less time, less money. And then there's also higher prevalence of ultra-processed food exposure and a more obesogenic environment. So that is an environment which cultivates people to overeat and overeat unhealthy foods. So whilst people are, like I say, cognizant of what they're doing and aware of what they need to do, that lens is warped by the way that the media portrays health to us. And then if you are living in an area which doesn't have access to healthy foods or adequate green space, then you're going to be less likely to be doing meaningful exercise. And later on in the conversation, I think it might be useful to talk about food deserts and food swamps. But I think that, for a starting point, it is really just around, talking about how diet and exercise can fit into general health and well-being, as opposed to just being boiled down to a simple thing of whether you're overweight or not.
So how would you say then it fits into, everyone's got busy lives these days, Lord knows, how do you see it, or how do you think people should perceive, albeit as you mentioned that it might vary from individual to individual, that we fit or think about this in our day-to-day lives?
There's guidance around this. What we would say in public health is that people should be aiming for about 150 minutes of moderate activity a week. So that's brisk walking or cycling. I'm a big fan of the cycle to work scheme. I know the weather here, it doesn't always feel compatible with that sort of activity, but it's a great way to, get to work, and you don't have to pay for parking, which if you're working in Douglas City, that's a real benefit. People should try and do strength training at least twice a week. And it's all about moving more, sitting less. So even in short bursts, about 5 to 10 minutes, it all counts and it all adds up.
And do you think we do, in a way, just as we are now with the digital revolution and such like, are we living much more sedentary lifestyles than some of our forebears?
Again, it's down to individuals. I think that we live in a car-dominated culture on the island, and I think that that culture means that people are walking from their living room to their car, driving to the location, walking a short distance there. And that could be perceived to be a more sedentary lifestyle. You've also got people who are working in desk and office jobs, increased rates of working from home. So maybe you're not even walking to your car anymore. You're just walking to your dining room or wherever your home study is set up. So I think there are elements where the digital revolution, in particular, the ability to work from home and work remotely, might be impacting the amount that people are moving. Conversely, though, that could actually mean that you have more time in your day to go out and get that half an hour of activity, moderate activity per day. So it can work both ways, but it's really just giving that message that anything is better than nothing and more is better than some.
Leslie, Manx Sport and Recreation. I mean, people have heard maybe MSR. Tell us about exactly who are they and what they actually do.
So Manx Sport and Recreation is based at the National Sports Centre, and it includes the National Sports Centre. And we offer all sorts of classes, schemes for every age group. We have classes that are for ladies who are expecting babies, that they can go swimming beforehand. Then we have classes afterwards where people can come with the babies and take the children swimming. And then to the other age range as well, to the other end of the age scale, we have lots of classes for everybody. We have classes that are high impact, low impact. We have classes indoors, outdoors. We have great schemes, especially for the children as well, where they can register for holiday schemes. So the children come, there's instructors there that arrange lots of activities for them. And I think one of the key things for me is that you get children in early and make it a normal thing to exercise. Whereas if it's normal, they'll continue to do it. Whereas if the parents don't exercise, the children are less likely to exercise, they won't come to the schemes. And that's where it starts. It's literally from the day you're born, moving around. We've got jumping jacks, which is the tiny little babies that crawl around on little bouncy cushioned apparatus, and they kind of, you know, roll around on the floor. And that's fantastic. And that's just getting people in when the babies, so they get used to coming to the National Sports Centre. We have High Rocks, which is a high impact intensive class that you can come and you run around and you carry weights and push sledges. And then we have Parasize, which I teach, which I absolutely love. And it's a gentle aerobic exercise that makes you smile. You can sing along to the music and it gets you moving and you don't realise that you're moving. We have so many things at the NSC. If people haven't been, they need to come to the NSC and have a look.
It's absolutely excellent at the NSC as well. I go to the spin classes there. It's an absolutely fantastic resource. And it's one of those things that, you know, it is there. It is available to everyone and it's exceptionally affordable. And it's a good way to go and
absolutely,
meet people,
yeah,
have a bit of a social activity, and sit on a bike and spin your legs.
Yep. Right.
Or push a sledge, depending on whatever you want.
Carry your weight.
But is there an element then that people, because Ross was saying, you know, you go to the spin class there, but if people perhaps haven't gone before thinking, oh, I'm not sporty, do they feel a little bit sort of thinking, oh, I'll feel out of place if I go to the...
I think if people haven't used a sports centre before, they may feel like that. What I tend to do is, so I meet people and show people around the National Sports Centre. So I bring them into the sports centre, I show them where the changing rooms are, show them where the classes are held, so they get a feel for the place. Whereas sometimes if you walk in off the street and you don't know where the toilets are and you don't know where the changing rooms are, it can be quite intimidating. The gym at the National Sports Centre, everyone is so friendly. It's a lovely gym. It's staffed by people who really care and are passionate about the customers that come in there. We're really lucky to have it.
But someone then, say, maybe someone listening to this podcast, say, I mean, I'm in my 60s now, someone perhaps my age, perhaps a bit older, maybe late 60s, 70s, listening, thinking, well, yeah, maybe I need to do a bit more exercise to keep myself, you know, keep myself strong, keep my core strong or whatever. Could they come along to the sports centre and actually speak to someone, not knowing really what they want to do or what they can do?
I would suggest that they come to the sports centre or even ring up and they can book an appointment with me. I will put myself out there that if somebody wants to come and talk about the National Sports Centre and what we've got on and what we offer people, I will talk them through it. I coordinate a scheme. We've got a few different schemes at the National Sports Centre where people can come and access it. And with that, if you introduce people to it and gently guide them through it and explain that it doesn't have to be 100 miles an hour, whatever you're doing, a little bit's good, more's better, obviously. But whatever you're able to do, just do what you can. That's the main thing. Whatever you're able to do, whether it's standing up and sitting down 10 times every 20 minutes when you're at home watching the television, or coming in and trying some of the classes at the sports centre, walking up and down in the water is amazing exercise. One side of the swimming pool is always a metre deep. We've got accessible stairs into it. And if people can't use the stairs, we've actually got a seat that lowers into the water. So it's accessible to everybody. If people want to talk about the National Sports Centre, they can chat to the people on reception, or I'll talk to them if they want to talk to me about it.
And I have to say, my wife loves walking or whatever, and thought I need to go to something else. Loves Parasize.
Does she?
Yes. Gone into Parasize, so I think it is, and I think you get, if she does, anyone will. It's great fun, and she feels the benefits. She said, I genuinely do feel better after a session of doing something. I mean, the years do go on, Dr. Andy Davis, consultant geriatrician at Manx Care. It is important, we were talking about obviously at any stage of life, to stay fit and eat well, but I suppose in a way your body's changed, your needs change as you get older. Is it important, or is it a different style of exercise we're thinking about as we age and perhaps head towards later life?
I think the scene has been set, hasn't it, that there's a culture that we need to embrace of healthy living. If you put exercise and good diet in at a younger age, it's far easier to continue that. Some of those mysteries we talked about, what does the gym look like? For me, probably for yourself, it was football or athletics that was your engagement with sport. So for a lot of older people, the gym is a really mysterious place to go. You know, it's full of these big machines with heavy weights and people dressed in Lycra, which is a scary thought for me. And so there is a degree of mystery about exercise, but as has been said, it can be something as simple as walking. There are specific things we can do, and there are things which we know evidence has shown us are really good. So there are exercises like walking that will be good for cardiovascular health, but more and more evidence about strengthening your muscles as you get older and keeping that muscle strength. And if you can do that, then you can reduce lots of health problems later down the line. Somebody once said to me, if I was offering you a pill that could stop you falling, improve your mental health, improve your bone health, you would take it in an instant. But if I told you that was exercise, you'd probably say, no thanks, I'd rather have the pill. And I think the point is that people really want a quick fix, and some of this, it isn't. It's an engagement with a lifestyle. But we know that putting that in early days and learning those habits can have significant benefits later on. So some of the inevitable things people assume of old age isn't necessarily true. By putting exercise in, you can offset some of those things. Mm. Yeah.
Just to get back to the Lycra.
Why not?
Of course.
At the National Sports Centre, you don't have to, people don't wear the latest gear, you know, Lycra trousers. You can turn up in whatever you're comfortable to wear. So it could be, we have people that come in chinos, we have people that come in loose-fitting trousers, and we also don't have really, really heavy weights in the gym, so we don't get really big muscle-bound people coming in to use the facility because we actually don't have those weights. So it's kind of aimed at just us to go in and not be a scary place to
Excellent.
Be.
So you don't need to be an Arnold Schwarzenegger or a Lululemon, no?
No, I did say to somebody about Arnold Schwarzenegger and they just looked at me. They were a young person. I'm old.
I guess as well, I'm sort of noticing that the conversation that we're having here is, you know, a lot about things like weight loss and there's an argument that maybe that's slightly shaming language. I think that I want to be talking about it more about, less like weight loss, but more health gain.
Mm-hmm. Not weight loss, but using weight training. So it's about building muscle rather than. So we were all cardiovascular health exercise. Yeah. The evidence now is building muscle is the way to preserve mm-hmm. age and bone strength. So less about necessarily weight management, more about keeping muscle strength up as you get older, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the thing around people being at classes and your partner going to the classes and enjoying that. Again, it's that link to sort of mental health and the psychosocial sort of health and well-being of being surrounded by like-minded people. And you know, it does extend beyond just the health benefit and the health gain of going to a class and having a bit of a sweat.
Yeah, and there's lots of evidence, I think, that for that now, isn't there? The sort of healthy diet and health and keeping a healthy lifestyle does play very much into your mental health as well.
I think people don't give exercise the credit it's due for your mental health and how well it can make you feel, and when you don't do it, how bad you can feel as well. So for me personally, I get up every morning and go for a walk or a run outside in the rain, come what may, and it's just that makes me able to manage the day, because sometimes we have very stressful lives and stressful days, and also manage kind of how I'm feeling about things. And just sometimes, even in the rain, it's really nice just to be outside. The gym isn't for everybody, which I completely understand, but just doing whatever you can. So even a little walk, you know, when the sun's up, when it is up, hasn't been here recently, but when it is out and you can get outside, like you say, just for 10 minutes, mm-hmm. 10 minutes is fantastic. Ring a friend, walk a couple of lampposts. You don't have to walk the whole length of the prom. You can do a couple of lampposts and go back home. Just even acknowledging somebody else in the street, because a lot of people, especially as they get older, spend so much time on their own, and that is no good for anybody. Although we're little creatures and we're social creatures, so we're meant to be with other people and talk to other people. And I just think that gets forgotten about as well. It's the social side that's really important.
So Andy, do people need to sort of think about a regime as they get older? I'm thinking maybe people coming up to retirement age, 65, 66, 67, they have more time on their hands. They might not be going out and being as active because they're not going to work anymore. Do they need to think about having a regime and maybe going to the gym or something? Or is it more a case of just altering their lifestyle? And as Leslie was saying, thinking about right, getting up, going for a walk every morning, maybe doing some yoga, maybe doing some weight-bearing exercises or something. Where do they sort of need to be thinking about that?
I think it's good for people to think about their health anyway. I don't think a lot of people wait until they hit a crisis, and that's the point at which they seek help. But actually, if we keep an eye on our health through our lives, we're much more likely to maintain that. And I think exercise is a part of that. I think social interaction is another part of it. These aren't just sound bites in the air. These are well researched. We know that interacting with people is one of the protective factors against dementia. Yep. We know that exercise in particular muscle groups and cardiovascular exercise prevents falling if we do certain types of exercise. So if I was, and I am at that point of looking at my life, looking backwards and looking forwards and thinking I would rather live an independent life, what is it I have to do now to manage my health, to keep an eye on things like maybe blood pressure or what I eat or how much salt I take in my diet, how much exercise am I doing, and not just how much exercise, but what type of exercise. You know, that for example, there's a specific muscle group at the top of your legs that you exercise when you stand up from a chair, when you go upstairs. You can exercise it quite easily by holding onto the sink and just doing a small crouch and standing back up again. That muscle group, just by exercising that on its own, will prevent falls. So of all the many, many things you can do, that's one muscle you can exercise that will give you a benefit. And I think you could talk about that across a range of things you can choose to do as you get older. But I think there is an element of choice. I'm going into my retirement years now. What am I going to do to prevent my health deteriorating? You know, the doctor's told me my blood pressure's a bit high. Let's have a read about that. What can I do to try and make that better other than taking medications? Medications will be part of it, but what other things are there that I could do? So I think those sort of things I would be asking myself, I have asked myself as I've approached that part of my life. So I think it's a kind of checking on your health, MOT on your health. Am I doing the sort of exercise that's going to be beneficial? I mean, making healthy choices.
I think it's interesting because a lot of people sell the houses and move into bungalows, and then you don't walk up and down the stairs. So when you are faced with a set of stairs,
bungalow legs.
My mum used to talk about bungalow legs when I was younger, and I used to poo-poo the idea and think she was talking absolute rubbish. And it's true. Bungalow legs, so you lose the strength in your legs because you're not walking up and down the stairs, you know, to take the washing up, to go to the loo. So living on a bungalow, in a bungalow, and then you see stairs and you're struggling to get up the stairs because you've lost all the strength. So the sit to stands or the little squats holding the kitchen bench are absolutely fantastic, and you don't have to really do anything to do that. You know, when the adverts come on the television, go make a cup of tea, hold onto the bench, do a few little squats.
And it's an interesting point, though. I hadn't heard the phrase bungalow legs before, but I see exactly where it's coming from. But it's sort of, the problem is, I suppose, a lot of people might be thinking, they might be in a, you know, big 4, 5, 6-bedroom house, they've had the kids. Kids have all fled the nest. They downsize. Yep. They think, I'll future-proof, I'll move into a bungalow.
This is, again, about the commercial determinants of health, again, like I was touching on before, about how the things that are sort of fed to us by the media, and, you know, we sort of see adverts, and portion control is now all sort of warped by what we see and our perception of therefore health. It's one of the things that I kind of noticed on the island is that actually a bungalow will attract a very high rate for you know, to purchase a bungalow is normally more expensive than to buy a similar square footage in a house. And that is because they are desirable to the older generation who have potentially more disposable income. So that's just something I've sort of noticed since I've moved over here. So it's almost like it's hardwired you know, to reach retirement age and move into that kind of living environment. What I think we need to be looking at is multi-generational households, which are adaptable through sort of simple measures. So you move into a house in your 20s, your 30s, but actually adapting that house into your older age through things like grab rails and making sure that there are no carpets with like lips up and all that kind of stuff. That to me feels like a more cost-effective and equitable way of managing where people live as they get older, because you want to make sure that, you know, people don't have to move into a bungalow. You just want to make sure that they have a safe, secure place to live, which is appropriate, intergenerational, family can come visit them, but they can also adapt it for their needs as they get older. And that kind of brings me to frailty, which I think is an interesting concept in itself, because you're not frail until you are. You know, I talk about it a lot in my public health role in terms of frailty prevention. How do we prevent people becoming frail? I mean, I want to start people doing that as soon as possible. You know, from the age of 10, you're running around. That's, you know, that's embryonic frailty prevention. So I guess I was just looking at you, Andy, and sort of asking about frailty and, you know, how does one define that? What does it mean? Because it's very much a clinical term. And then what would you recommend if somebody is told that they are frail? Can you come back from that? Is it a death sentence? I mean, what does that mean from a clinical perspective?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think we use the term frailty a lot. We've just had a debate about our clinic, which is called a frailty clinic, because nobody wants to come to a clinic and be told they're frail. So we've changed it to the resilient aging clinic, which we think is a much better term, because that's what we're trying to do. Is trying to facilitate good years in the golden years of your life. I think here, people often feel they retire and then that's it. You know, I haven't put my feet up. If you go to somewhere like Italy, retirement is the beginning of life for them there. It's the dolce vita. You know, they're out with their friends having coffee, they're walking by the lake, they're enjoying life. And I think it's that switch in mentality that I'm getting older, but actually I'm going to embrace those years. So frailty isn't, it's not a disease in terms of a diagnosis disease. It's more an accumulation of things. So it's when you get a number of conditions, your body's not able to respond and fight those conditions in quite the same way. It's about having less resilience, it's a bit able to move less, so not able to do the things that are required, the essential activities of your life, you're not able to do. Quite a lot of that is around muscle function, and there's quite a lot of evidence as when your muscles begin to deteriorate and they become weak, what the term would be sarcopenia, you can do less of those things. So obviously, back to bungalow legs, But it applies wider than that, and it even goes down to sort of the muscle cells themselves, the little battery cells within muscles, the mitochondria. We know that as they deteriorate, people start to have more and more health problems. So if you can strengthen those muscles by exercising and relaxing, those mitochondria charge themselves. Even just doing that helps people and prevents the kind of frail complexes we're talking about, where you can't do as much, where you get ill and you can't shake it. You go to hospital and you should be in and out in a day, and you're there for 3 weeks because the illness takes much longer, the antibiotics take longer to respond. That's the sort of frailty complexes we're talking about.
And when we're talking about this as well, and you know, the health and social care structure on the island, frailty is a huge expenditure. If you experience a fall and you are frail and you're in the situation where you're an inpatient in hospital for a long period of time because you can't get better, that's obviously problematic, and it's taking up a bed. And we want to try and make sure that people aren't that level of frail that they have to be in hospital for a prolonged period of time, keep them healthier for longer so people can get out of hospital sooner. And therefore, that's a reduced expenditure to the health and social care system.
And I think it also, I suppose, getting back, we were talking about sort of mental health as well. I suppose there's this element, and certainly I can say from, you know, from people I've seen, if they do in later life, you know, maybe do have a tumble or they have a trip or something and end up hospitalised, it also, as well as the physical side, it also knocks the mental side, and their confidence quite often goes, and then they don't feel they want to go out as much and be as active, and then you're into a vicious circle.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And we're all nodding here. I think we recognise that, and it's very common. So one in three over 65s will fall in 1 year. So in some ways, it's almost, you can almost expect there's a likelihood you could fall. But that the consequence of, I fell, I'm not going to go out now, I could hurt myself, is huge. So we need to encourage people to learn the things that they can do to make it them less likely to fall, exercising those muscles. We can even teach people how to get up safely off the floor if they do fall, because some of these things are inevitable consequences of life. I think looking at all of us in this room, at some point in our life, we'll have fallen over. Mm. The thing is, we were young enough for it not to really bother us. We probably laughed and got on with it. So somebody described to me, you can tell how old somebody is when they fall, because if you're young, your friends laugh at you. When you're middle-aged, you laugh at yourself. And when you're older, nobody laughs at all. They all race around to help.
Yes, it's when have you not fallen over, but you've had a fall. That's the key distinction, yeah. Isn't it? I think that also, we seem to be focusing a lot about on exercise and movement and stuff as well here, but I also think there's a really important part about diet and nutrition, mm-hmm. healthy eating. Mm-hmm. And I guess I wanted to know if Leslie, in your role at MSR, if there's anything that you guys do around, you know, what a healthy plate might look like, or any messaging around healthy eating.
We don't particularly do anything at MSR. That we have the Activate scheme, so they do go out and kind of give talks on nutrition. But when people come and visit or are referred through a scheme, it could be for a variety of reasons. And we haven't anything to kind of hand out to them. A while ago, they used to be referred to Weight Watchers free of charge. They used to get a set referral to Weight Watchers, which I don't think happens anymore. And so we kind of try and just give them a little bit of advice. You know, if they say, oh, well, every night I'm having a takeaway, you kind of go, you know, well, can you maybe knock that down to maybe two instead of seven, or maybe three instead of seven, just to start off with, and kind of just try and say to them, you know, do you drink enough water? How much alcohol? Because when we talk to people, it's not normally on a one-to-one basis. There's normally other people around, so you don't really try to get into too much personal detail with people because they're a bit...
But hydration's super interesting,
hydration,
as well, because, yeah, you know, it impacts older people disproportionately. If you're older, you're not well hydrated, you're more likely to get UTIs, more likely to fall, because your circulatory pressure is lower if you're dehydrated, skin problems and even cognitive impairment. So there's a whole bunch of stuff there. And it's quite interesting as well, because you look at all the youths of today. They're all walking around with their...
Water.
Their massive vats of water. It's almost a bit of a competition. Who can carry the largest bottle of water? And that isn't something that's happening necessarily maybe in the Stanley Cup hasn't caught on with the over 65s is what I suppose I'm trying to say. Other brands of water cup are available.
It's a fascinating point, and you're right. I mean, I often think, as it wasn't my generation of carrying your water around, and particularly when obviously tap water here is safe to drink and you're never that far from a tap. But I suppose from a health point of view, that's got to be a great thing. If people are taking their hydration seriously and they literally are carrying their hydration with them, they're more likely to hydrate more, I
see. Yeah, but it's got to be water or you know, a sugar-free cordial or something like that, because you know, sugary drinks that people, you know, sort of see carrying around, these large, ghastly cans of Monster, for example. sugar can have negative impacts on all stages of life. And I guess from my perspective, I'm a dentist by profession, just really aware of how excess sugar consumption can impact on people's oral health as well. Mm-hmm. And that, again, ties into mental health and well-being, ability to function. How can you stay, how can you eat appropriately if all your teeth have been taken out because of oral disease? So it can cause pain, be really disruptive. So it's trying to make sure that what you are consuming and to stay hydrated isn't going to have that negative impact on your oral health as well.
Staying on the theme of let's say hydration and also nutrition as well, you sort of touched on it a little bit earlier on. Do we have the problem on the Isle of Man specifically about being depending on where you are on the sort of the earnings scale, sort of your sort of lower pay, are you less likely to eat well? Is that true? Or again, is that something that's perpetuated by the media?
So it's a really interesting point. And I did talk about food deserts and food swamps earlier. So a food desert is an area where there's very limited access to fresh, affordable and nutritious food. And we find that, that typically affects rural or deprived urban areas. So imagine if you live, you know, up the top end of Bride, your nearest Tesco is a very long way away. And then because of absence, you don't have the healthy food available to you. Whereas a food swamp is an overload of unhealthy options. So healthy food does exist. I'm thinking Strand Street now, but it's drowned out by fast food, takeaways, really readily available ultra processed options. It's cheap, it's convenient, and it's common in these urban deprived areas. So the problem there is that you've got oversaturation of food availability, and that food availability is poor. So you find that you're getting both of those things in areas with more deprivation, and you're also getting therefore more exposure to those things in areas with more deprivation. So you are more likely to make those choices, and it follows the social gradient. What I want to do from a public health perspective around policy and how we make the environment that people live in healthier is to make their healthier choice the easy choice. And there's a number of things I can do from that perspective, because in my opinion, Andy does a fantastic job, but I want to stop people having to need to access the
resilient aging
clinic. Yep. Yeah. And so that's my take on it. I think there are policy things that we can do and things that we can do within the community before people get sick to stop them from needing access to, you know, this tertiary healthcare when they are already so sick that they need support.
Does anybody know whether they still do cookery lessons at school?
I have. So, yes.
We had a discussion about this the other day. And
I know, I did at school, didn't I?
We did, and we all made pineapple upside down cake and scrambled egg on toast to start off with and rock buns. But I just think as well, that's just a basic skill that I don't think a lot of adults have that are, wouldn't like to be, say, maybe in the 40s. I know I was taught to cook at home by my mother, and that's seen me through all my life. Then the next generation, or my kind of generation that had children, I think because maybe both people worked, they maybe weren't as active in the cookery side. So then the next generation that comes down, I kind of find that younger ones don't tend to cook as much as I do or would have at the same age. And we were just discussing whether cookery lessons were still on and how to kind of, you know, make a shopping list so you can go to the shops and pick the ingredients to make a full meal instead of coming home with one thing that's going to make one meal. And so that's where the discussion was about cookery lessons and do they still have them.
So I think that the evidence would indicate that your palate is formed when you're of primary school age, and then your habits in terms of how you cook and prepare food is formed when you're sort of secondary school age. So if you're not exposed to, I don't know, a certain kind of food or a certain texture of food when you're very young, you are less likely to enjoy that type, the taste of that food and the texture of that food when you're slightly older. If you're not exposed to how to use anything other than a deep fat fryer when you're aged between 11 and 18, you're probably going to get into the habit of doing that yourself as you go into later life, because that's all you know. So I think it's really important that we you know, part of this conversation is education and how do we educate the children who are currently in our educational settings to be able to tolerate and understand the need for, you know, this healthy plate where you're eating five fruit and veg a day, lean meats, all your pulses and beans rather than refined foods. And then making sure that, you know, once you've got the appetite for it, you're able to prepare it safely as well.
And just staying on that briefly for a moment, Ross, do you think there's, again, with the sort of changes in lifestyle, people have busy lifestyles, we're all switched on 24/7 all the time and people are out, and we now have this, people coming in and out, we have to a degree a breakdown of the family unit, so people tend not to eat necessarily as a family as we did all the time when I was growing up. People, they just sort of graze and pick, and then also you have obviously your deliveroos, as it were. There's so many people say, "Oh well, I'm really tired tonight. It's busy. We'll just have something."
Other food delivery services are available, of course.
They are naturally, but they can come from, you know, wherever it might be. Your favourite pasta joint, your favourite burger joint, they will deliver to your door in an awful lot of places, which just makes life very easy and convenient, but not necessarily the healthiest way forward.
It sort of comes back to, you know, the ease of the choice. So if an unhealthy choice is particularly easy for an individual, then you are more likely to make that choice. And there's lots of behavioural science which would indicate that we take the path of least resistance where possible, as part of human nature. So if the food delivery companies were offering a £10 healthy food basket, which could feed a family of four for three nights, well, that would obviously change the behaviours of a family unit, because they would have access to cheap food, which is nutritious and healthy, maybe recipe cards that go with it, sort of more in the style of a food delivery company as opposed to a takeaway company, because that way you are making that healthier choice easier, more sustainable. And I think that in terms of, you know, the commercial side of that is that we probably have to start thinking as a government and, can we work with these commercial providers who are present on the island to make that kind of offer? And the answer is, I don't know. But it's something that we need to consider in terms of a healthy weight strategy moving forward.
Hmm. So that's something you think would be a good way for, as you say, from a policy point of view, I guess, going forward, actually working with these companies rather than sort of letting them do their own thing?
I think from a policy perspective, we need to change something, because we clearly live in an obesogenic environment where if there is an abundance of food offered to people, a multiplicity, if not a majority of people, will choose to indulge and overeat. So I think there needs to be policy changes around how we manage healthy eating on the island to try and make sure that we shift the scales on that obesogenic environment, and an environment which generates obesity, into one which is more, healthogenic, but one which is generating health and making sure that people are in the best physical and mental health that they possibly can be. And part of that, is policy, and it has to come from the government.
Nothing tastes as nice as something homemade, I don't think.
I agree.
You can go out for lovely meals, which are really nice, but nothing tastes actually standing and preparing it, shopping for it and preparing it and doing it as a family or a unit. I think you can't beat it. And then for parents, they can learn so much from their children about that child's day by just doing simple tasks, by when you stood chatting, talking, chopping things up, they tell you things that if you're all sat in front of the telly eating a pizza and you're on your phones and you're not communicating, and maybe I live in an idealistic world, but I kind of think sometimes it's getting back to basics, what we used to do, and I don't think that's a bad thing to kind of sit down and go, right, what would you like to eat at the weekend? Let's maybe have a think about it. Let's think what would be a great thing to have to eat. Right, let's prepare it. Let's make it. Maybe set a challenge for the school, say, right, maybe over the next month, if you can just once in the month kind of make a meal, here's some recipe cards, here's some ideas that you can have a go at and see what you think.
And it's not even like we're driven by seasonal fruit and veg anymore. No. You can get anything any time of the year. Mm-hmm. So, this is an option. And the reason I completely agree with what you're saying, and the reason I keep bringing this back to policy is because changing policy allows us to move the baseline where we're starting from. And if you move the baseline, then you're obviously pushing everybody up and making things better for everybody. So that's why I think a policy approach to this is what stops people from needing to access healthcare services, and, is what pushes people to into accessing services which allow them to improve their physical activity and mental well-being.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting point, Leslie, as you were saying it. I was lucky, I grew up in a family where we ate together and my mum would cook virtually all the meals. I don't ever remember, really, other than maybe occasionally fish and chips, ever having sort of takeouts when I grew up. And so, I'd always see my mum sort of cooking, and I would sort of help her as a child and such like. So I grew up that way with an interest in it, and I've always liked cooking, and I still, cook now every day. I suppose, getting back to what you were saying as well, Ross, that sort of, if kids are coming up now and the chances are perhaps their parents might not be working or have come through that sort of same sort of way, they're more likely to be accessing takeaways or instant meals or such like, then you don't have that experience to build off, which is sort of, again, gets to a bit of a vicious circle unless you can inspire something different.
And I'm keen not to put any blame here on the family unit.
No.
I think we are all products of our environment, and the environment that we now live in is one which is driven very, very much by the commercial determinants of health. It is driven by the fact that you can't turn on your TV without seeing a Coca-Cola advert, without seeing a Deliveroo advert. We talk about big tobacco. I think that it's probably fair that we should start talking about big sugar. I think that sugar is as damaging to your general health and well-being in terms of weight gain, potential for developing diabetes, as much as tobacco was 50, 60 years ago. So that's another conversation that we have to have. High sugar drinks, of course, we have the sugar tax levy here. Is that going far enough? Is that deterring people enough? And the answer to that is potentially not.
we should be doing more with that? Because again, I think certainly in this part of the world, in Western Europe, we do have a very high sugar intake still, don't we?
We do, and I would suggest that the levels of obesity that we have on the island, so 64% of the island are overweight or obese, and 40% are reporting low physical activity. So I would say that, yes, it's that high sugar intake, because the way that sugar is very short release energy. So if you intake a large amount of sugar and you don't release it, so you're not doing sports or whatever, you sat on your sofa eating some Maltesers or other chocolate confectionaries, of course, available, that isn't going to be burnt off. And then the process in your body is that excess energy, which is within the sugar, is stored in your body as fat. And so that's why there is the link between sugar and fat. It's not fatty foods which are necessarily bad for you. Some fats are very good for you, and you should be thinking about making sure that you are consuming healthy fats as part of your healthy plate. But it's the abundance of sugar and the way that the sugar is stored when you eat it in excess, which is the concerning thing.
It's that highs and lows, isn't it, as well? You eat the sugar because you're tired, then you have that drop, so you eat something else sugary because you've had another drop, so you're on that cycle and you just end up eating rubbish because you get that quick fix of the sugar, kind of, oh, I feel a bit better, oh well, there's a bit of chocolate, I'll have that chocolate bar. And it's that, and it's getting out of that cycle with the sugar hit and the low and the hit and the low. And
yeah, and is hidden sugars a major issue? Because again, if you're cooking from scratch and making your meal, you know exactly what's going in and how much sugar's there. If you're using, it might be a very tasty, very good ready meal that you can pop in the microwave, whatever the case may be, unless you actually read the list of ingredients, you don't know how much sugar's in there.
The three things that are delicious: fat, salt, sugar. So they are going to be in ready meals in abundance, because that is what the human palate craves, and it's what we want to eat. And I do hear arguments about how healthy eating is more expensive, and there's this perception that it's more expensive. But I'm just sort of thinking about ways that you can reduce that. So, for example, I'm a man, I live on my own. If I buy fresh fruit and veg, it goes off before I can get through it all. So I buy frozen fruit and veg, which is actually exceptionally affordable, and it just stays in my freezer. I can throw it in my my homemade pasta sauce or whatever very easily, and that's just like a simple swap that I've made as I've become more aware of the fact that I'm in my mid-30s now. I want to make healthier choices, so that's something which I think could be a more cost-effective way of getting your fruit and veg in.
And thinking, just coming into older life, Andy, it's a case of, does your diet really alter? By and large, people, certainly the older folk I know, or people senior to me, tend to eat less than they did when they were younger. And hydration, again, I certainly saw it with my own dad. I never realised the link before between UTIs and hydration. And in much later life, yes, if he wasn't well hydrated, he wasn't really in the room. If the hydration levels were okay, then all was well. I was amazed.
Yeah, exactly. And exactly the point that Ross made earlier, hydrating keeps your kidneys flushed, gives your blood circulating blood volume a boost, so you're less likely to get a blood pressure drop when you stand up. And very simple ways of checking on your hydration, which is to have a look at the colour of your pee. Is it orange? Need to drink a lot more. Can you hardly see it? You're probably hitting the right amount of fluid that you should be taking. But then it would be wrong for me as a geriatrician not to acknowledge that older people have a problem of racing to the loo. Often they'll say, I'm going out shopping today, so I'm not going to have a drink. So we appreciate that, there's a balance to be struck. But you would make the point that hydration is good for you. If you do need to make some adjustments to your lifestyle because you think you're going to have to race to the toilet, do that, but always have a name to be drinking more, and keeping your pee a good colour, I think, is probably reasonable. And I was going to ask Ross a question, because before you made the point about, I don't think we've ever been bombarded with more health information or dietary information or exercise information in our lives, and certainly not for me. And so how do I go about? So, when I'm looking at my news feeds, of which I try to be as varied as possible, so much information. How do you begin to know that's a good thing I can do, or that isn't? That for me is a real challenge.
I think I would say that going to TikTok for health advice isn't always necessarily the right thing to do, and there is a great deal of evidence-based information out there. as a government organisation, we're obviously not going to be promoting anything which could be harmful to your health. And, you know, I see a lot of fatty diets on TikTok and carnivore diets and butter diets and all this kind of stuff, which people claim is making them healthier because they get to live like a caveman. Publichealth.gov.im is a really good resource, actually, I'd say. I don't think you're deliberately setting me up for that one. Some shameless marketing. But I would say that we've got plenty of information on there around what a healthy plate looks like. If you Google healthy plate, you'll end up with the Food Active website, and that will tell you, you know, what sort of things should be on a healthy plate. In terms of physical activity, again, that's on our website, the 150 minutes of exercise a week. We are currently in the process of looking at the needs of the population in terms of healthy weight. So obviously we have overweight and obesity. We've also got people who are underweight. So we need to consider sort of across the whole paradigm there, and that's going to result... It should result in a strategy around what we can do from a policy level, what we can target to people in the community, and then actually what healthcare looks like as well, in terms of making sure that people are able to access the care that they need to be able to maintain a healthy weight.
Exactly. And I think the one thing that I would say, you'll love your point earlier, Leslie, about, you know, get out and just do something, even if it's just a walk with your friends. And I would say find some healthy habits and choose an achievable healthy habit, even if that's standing in front of the sink and doing those mini squats, you know, two or three times, standing on one leg, or trying to when you're brushing your teeth. The little things, you can add them to your life, but they do make a difference. And I think it's the same with diet, isn't it? You might not wholesale change everything, but you might choose to say, I usually have two takeouts a week, I'm going to go down to one, and I'm going to flip that for some frozen veg in my homemade pasta sauce, which probably is reasonably straightforward to make. And I think if we could get people thinking along those lines and employing some of those healthy options, it would make a big difference. I think one of the mysteries for older people that would be really nice to get to help them with is that undoubtedly now the evidence is weight resistance training, so even just some gentle weights, strengthens muscles, improves mitochondrial function, improves bone health. And so I think if I was an older person listening to this, I might ask myself, are there sort of minor weightlifting type things I can do, not pumping iron,
tins of beans.
That takes me back to Mr. Motivator.
Yeah, exactly. Two bottles of water.
Just they're 500 mils. Yeah. It's half a kilogram.
Well, if you have 1 liter bottles of water, that would be your recommended intake of water for the day as well. You should aim for 2 liters. I was just thinking that when you were talking about
it. You're one in each arm.
Start with them full, but then drink them afterwards. Yeah.
And so I think what I would say to somebody that I saw in clinic, well, firstly, don't expect me as the doctor to solve every problem. I think that's unfair. It's your health. And I think I can give you a pill for some things, but actually some of the greatest benefits are lifestyle changes. What little lifestyle change could you put in? It might be minor. It might be just that walk with a friend. It might be just doing a few squats at the kitchen sink. Just start small. It might be a switch, but I think start thinking about healthy choices. Fibre, we've not talked about fibre, but even
should we talk about fibre?
Even if you just put a little bit of fibre in your diet, you can begin to change the bacterial population of your bowel to good, healthy bacteria. Mm-hmm. And that in itself helps with weight loss and weight management and sugar management.
And from your perspective, dealing with an older cohort of people, polypharmacy, so taking a lot of medications, that can obviously cause constipation, which is where fibre is very important in sort of preventing that. So for older individuals, I would say that, yeah, sneaking some fibre into your diet is never going to be a bad thing, particularly if you're taking a wide range of medication.
Absolutely. I would say come to the NSC with your friend. Get a friend, come to the NSE, grab a timetable, sit down, have a coffee or a cup of tea or a drink of water, look at the timetable and see what's on offer and do one thing.
Yep.
Just one class. Speak to the instructor beforehand if you've got any health conditions, explain what's wrong, and all the classes can be adapted. We have chair aerobics, which is quite exciting. We have chair-based classes where we do leg strength, where we do fall prevention. We use bands to use strength. If I show people around the gym and they're looking at the weights machines and I can think that they really don't like the look of them, say, right, when you're at home, 2 tins of beans or tins of soup, bicep curls, lateral raises, shoulder presses. that's a start. You don't have to do the weights in the gym. If all you want to do is the cardio stuff in the gym, do that. But maybe do a few stretches when you're at home.
Yeah. There are things you can do.
You don't have to come to the gym to do everything. But sometimes it's just nice because you can target certain areas. And maybe if you're on the treadmill, when you're walking, you can keep it at a nice steady pace. You can make the hills go up and down. And you haven't walked to the end of the prom and then have to walk back the other way and you think, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it. And then you can mix it up with the bike and the row machine. And that's fantastic exercise. The row machine is amazing. It works everything. But all the other stuff that we've got, all the other classes, gentle circuits, not so gentle circuits, there's lots of stuff. So come and have a little look at the NSC, especially with the weather, because the weather's a bit rubbish at the moment. You can stay indoors and meet some nice people. We have a group that come to the NSC and they come in the gym and they are called the Broken Hearts Brigade or Broken Hearts Club. And they've all come through cardiac rehab and they come twice a week and they've got a little group and they sit and have a coffee afterwards in a chat. And it's lovely.
Some wonderful advice. It is a case of some of it's common sense, some of it you don't have to get down to the gym or put on your Lululemons, whatever. It's changing your lifestyle, it's eating sensibly. It's, as you see, we're touching on fibre there, so you know you don't have to have all bran. You could be eating spring greens or green vegetables or broccoli or pulses and such like to get fibre in. There are ways around this. Just to finish off, it's a massive topic and we've just really touched on it really today, chatting about it. And it's a fascinating topic because it affects everyone from cradle to grave, does it not? Perhaps just if we have sort of one word, because people listening to this say, yeah, I'm loving all this, great stuff, right, where do I go? So perhaps if we just start with you, then Ross, people thinking, okay, I'd like to maybe make a change. I'm sort of, perhaps I need a little bit more information about how much is enough exercise? What can I do to maybe make my diet a little healthier? How much should I be drinking for a healthy hydration? Where's a good place to go to actually get information for them?
So as I've said before, second plug for this one, publichealth.gov.im is the public health government website, and there is a whole raft of information there on healthy eating, hydration, how to stay physically fit and active. And I guess from a personal perspective, I guess it's all about, if people are listening to this and are thinking of making some changes, it's all about starting small and being kind to yourself. And I just want to ensure that the healthy choice becomes the easy choice as we move forward.
Lovely. Leslie, we were talking about Manx Sport and Recreation. We said it's a friendly bunch down there, as you said. Go and try, check something out. Just go and have a see. There's going to be something that will fit in, whether it's Parasize or whether it's when you're kids or whether it's the rocks, whatever. Where do people get in contact if they want to find out more?
So msr.gov.im, if they look on the website, it has all the classes on there that we have. Or give the receptionist a call at the NSC or ring the receptionist and ask them to put them through to me, and they can leave me a voicemail and I will ring them back and I'll chat them through some of the things that we do there. It's just trying to let people know it actually isn't a scary place, although I can understand why people are frightened to go into a sports centre because they think everybody's 18 and in Lycra. And I assure they aren't. So if you want to go somewhere where they are, you'll have to go somewhere else.
Some of them are 65 and in Lycra.
that'd be me, probably. And Andy, if someone's at the upper age of the age spectrum, you were saying before, maybe just recently retired, maybe to wanting to try and tweak their lifestyle to actually live healthier longer, where's a good place to go to access more information about what they can be doing to help themselves?
I think you go to Ross's website,
publichealth.gov.im.
All I would say is there is a massive amount of information, and the source of it is really important. So make sure it's either a government-based website, that could be UK government, it could be the Isle of Man government, or an established health organisation. So it might be a health university that's well known from the States or the UK, Oxford, etc. They're publishing stuff that is evidence-based. It's not faddy. It has definite benefit to it. So make sure you look very carefully when you're reading information.
Lovely. Ross Keat, Consultant of Public Health. Leslie Cunningham, Health and Wellbeing Coordinator at the MSP and also MSR, I should say, and also Dr. Andy Davies, Consultant Geriatrician in Manx Care. Thanks very much for chatting to us on the Health Podcast today.
You're very welcome.
Cheers.
Thank you.